amazed how many people own stocks.
Welcome to Playing Footsie, the podcast where we talk about stocks, investing, and personal finance. Before we start, we want to make it clear that the information presented on this show is for informational and entertainment purposes only. None of us is a financial advisor, and this is not financial advice. Investing in the stock market comes with risks, and we strongly encourage our listeners to do their own research and consult with a licensed financial advisor before making any investment decisions. Now, let's dive into the world of finance and talk about what we're doing with our money.
The sucker's going up.
Welcome to the Playing Footsie show, brought to you in association with Trading 212. My name's Steve W. This week, Weatherspoons has been pushing up the price of its pint, Warren Buffett has been selling Apple shares, and something called JFrog has jumped by 30%. But we haven't got time to talk about any of those things, because I've got Steve D with me, and we found other things that we'd like to discuss. Steve, how's your week been?
Yeah, really busy week. We've, for the UK dropping into recession like it has, we've had a very good start to the year from a point of from the building trade. So inquiries are up to our eyeballs, loads of orders, and it's all going quite nicely at the moment. Let's hope that continues, because that will be a good thing for us. Portfolio wise, Steve, not so bad. I was looking at it today on Google Finance. I'm up about 1% this week, which I guess is, compared to last week, terrible. Compared to normal, that's pretty cracking. I've had a big rebound today in a lot of my REIT holdings. I've got some pretty big REIT holdings. A really big week for Bloomsbury, which has gone up quite considerably for me. And Enphase as well has had a really, really good week. So I've been doing pretty well. I've Doc Martens as well, Steve. How can we forget? I've actually made a sell this week, which is fairly unusual for me at the moment. I'm trying not to sell some things, but for those who don't know, we were on the JKR show midweek. I think it was Wednesday it came out, or Tuesday night, and Jacob asked us very late notice about Airtel Africa and what we thought about essentially the currency issues, and we answered the questions the best of our ability, really. Laid in bed on the night, I was feeling pretty reflective, Steve, and I sat there and I thought about all the things I know about the Nigerian Naira and the ways that it can be controlled, and I took a look at how badly that is affecting Airtel Africa's earnings, and I thought to myself, actually, that's a risk I don't want to be exposed to anymore. I've got plenty of good going on in the portfolio, and I actually think I would be better off holding the cash. So if you want to laugh at a bit of lost pawn, my pie is linked in my Twitter. You can go and have a look at what a 20% loss looks like. But yeah, much more happy with the cash, Steve. It was one of those positions that I think I'd forgotten about the risks on that, or maybe not assessed them well enough. When it was really in front of my eyes, I sort of looked at it and thought, there's not a lot I can do about this. And that's not the risk I really like, Steve.
I'm going to end where you ended as well, by the way. I mean, one thing I would say for you is that if you, it feels to me like more like I hadn't really seen it coming, risks with the Naira, rather than incorrectly weighed them but tried to factor them in. That would be my guess anyway. But I mean, there's plenty of people on Twitter that can assess the risks on the Naira for you. You're not minded towards letting them help, I guess. It's suddenly everyone's an expert on that, like they were an expert on COVID and Chinese stocks and everything else before and since, and defense and everything that we've had. From there, I think you're probably best doing your own research on that one. Good news, though, for you, Steve. You did successfully, as did I, correctly predict the winner of the Super Bowl. The Kansas City Chiefs, as you remember, you confidently went for, managed to overcome the San Francisco 49ers in overtime, which meant that Sunday night was a very, very late night for me, staying up watching that. Enjoyed it an awful lot, though. It was really good. Very highly error-strewn game. Nothing on the big one in Hull at the moment, but a good watch, and I'm always pleased to stay up for that one. Portfolio-wise, it's also half-term here, by the way, so it's not a good time to be tired if you're me. There's extra childcare going and extra bits and trying to figure out how to join everything up and work out how to keep going, because we don't stop at work, but we do stop at childcare, which is a bit of a problem, and Ofsted are in where my wife works, so she's also in and busy and indisposed for quite a bit of things. Portfolio-wise, which probably more people are interested in, I was feeling pretty pleased at myself. I just looked up how I'd done over the last week compared to the indices, and I haven't done as well as you, but I have done better than them. So you said you were up about 1%, I think, if that's right.
That's right, yep.
1%. So V-Whirl, which we is the kind of main thing I think that we compare ourselves to, is up 0.56%. The FTSE 100, which we don't compare ourselves to, is up 0.03%, which is technically up. And anything being technically up in the UK is, I suppose, kind of impressive. The S&P 500 is up basically 0.5%, 0.49 when I looked earlier, and I'm up 0.6%, or as the guy from Lyft would call it, 600%. I am up. I was kind of pleased with that until I heard that you had managed to be up like 1 million basis points or something like that. So, well done. I've also gone for an unscheduled sale as well. In my case, it's because I didn't work out a risk properly, and it's a stock I talked about on here beforehand. No one wrote into me about it, but I did flag it to you a little while ago. Supermarket Income REIT, which I like the look of because it owns a load of supermarkets and it's a REIT. And there's stuff around people buying back their supermarkets, which is fine because it's currently trading at less than the value of its assets. So if you liquidate the thing, you get an immediate payout. I had a look at their most recent dividend, and they said that because the stock is trading too cheap, they are scrapping their... or doing away with for this round their scrip dividend, which basically allows you to take your dividend in stock rather than in cash. And I wasn't aware they had a scrip dividend before. I'm not sure Trading 212 particularly allowed that. But what it did mean is that as a result of people taking their dividends in stock, their share count has gone through the sodding roof over the last few years. You expect this from a REIT. You do expect the share count to grow because it's how they finance acquisitions and how they finance purchases and how they basically drive rent higher in a lot of cases, barring kind of inflation-linked price hikes. But I looked at that and I thought, even for a REIT, this is something else. I'd been busy trying to build that into a position and eventually gave up on the idea of building it as a position. So I got rid of it and rolled it all into primary health properties instead, combining my sort of REITs into one, the one that I think is the better one. And then immediately, of course, got a dividend from the thing I'd forgotten that I had sold. But there we are. Always nice to get surprise dividends. So yeah, an unscheduled sale for me as well. Not planning on hanging around in cash though particularly. And I don't know. I don't suppose you are either.
No, I've not got any great ideas at the moment though, Steve. So it might be cash for a little bit longer. I've got more cash going into the portfolio. I'll actually finish the ISA tomorrow. So there's that as well. So I'm not, I had a quick look through everything on my watch list and there was only really one stock that was jumping out to me as one that I'm interested in at the moment, and it's Ball. I don't know if you've ever come across that before, Steve. They essentially make
Is it the Tin
cans.
Can Company? Yeah.
Yeah, Tin Can Company. And it's one I've pitched to Paul before as well,
I've seen
believe.
It, I think.
Yeah, and he asked me why its free cash flow is so lumpy, and I sent him a chart of the aluminium price, and that's essentially all you've got to know about that company. Is there's more and more people drinking cans of something, but it doesn't necessarily matter who drinks it. It's all on the aluminium price. So a company I quite like the look of. It's trading pretty cheap. I also think Albemarle is probably worth another look, although it's double where I sold it still, Steve. So I missed the sixfold run-up. But it is quite an attractive company. I think perhaps the sort of doom and gloom on lithium is overdone. But to be honest with you, either of them, I could not buy either of those and be equally as happy as I am at the moment.
I was looking at some 13Fs this week, mostly because I looked at the Berkshire one and it wasn't that interesting, so we're not going to talk about it here, and I don't have anything particularly insightful to offer you. We could sit and speculate about what Buffett's mystery stock is, but let's save that for another day when we've got less things to actually talk about that we know some things about. One thing I saw from across the kind of sweep of portfolios that I was looking at, not really Berkshire's one, but some of the others, is that people seem to think that Q4, and that's of course not terribly long ago, was the time to be buying miners. And that got me wondering about sort of Albemarle. Every time I run out of ideas for things to look at, I go and look at Newmont again and start thinking to myself, decent quality gold miner, doesn't look massively expensive at the moment, kind of thing you could sit in there. And then I always get round to the thought of thinking, I can't be bothered to follow it particularly closely in this company. I don't have a real sense of it having a distinctive vision for something that Barrick doesn't. I get that its mines are located in different places and so on and so forth, but I don't have a strong sense of what differentiates it from the rest of them. But I also kind of wonder about mining and whether now might be a window to buy mining things. It's hard to buy Southern Copper at these prices at the moment. I'm still looking at a biggish green number whenever I turn my attention that way.
Yeah, not interested in Southern Copper here, or Freeport McMoRan as well, which would have been another one to look at in the copper space. But I'm sure there are opportunities out there, Steve. We've never shied away from finding these things, so I'll have a good dig around. I noticed that Monday.com took a bit of a hit after its earnings, but it's still up about 24% this year, Steve, so... I'm sure there are things that we'll buy. It's just a case of having to sort of hunt them out at the moment.
Fair enough. Have you consumed anything interesting this week, Steve? I mean, you've been looking at tin cans. Consumed anything out of those or listened to anything interesting?
I have listened to something interesting, and I do have a fridge full of Rubicon, which I noticed was made by Ball, and Iron Brew, both made by Ball. I think they're both AG Barr products as well, so that probably doesn't
they
surprise.
They are both AG Barr products, yeah.
Yeah, so that doesn't surprise me that they're using the same supplier. But that's not what I've consumed, although it is something I have consumed. I'm going back to the well, Steve, which I apologise to anybody who considers this lazy, and I'm not searching out new things for you, but just sort of going on from last week's sort of feeling when you and I were having our chat, Steve, about the well being an incrementally better place. We got some nice feedback from that in the Discord and in comment section from people saying, actually, that was really helpful to hear that. So I'm going to put forward something else for you just to just make you feel a little bit better about the world and why potentially seeing incremental change is difficult. And so I'm going to put forward the Morgan Housel podcast for you. And the episode is the latest one that came out on Valentine's Day, and it's called Compounding Optimism. It's a really... interesting sort of 10 or 15 minutes podcast where he explains to you just really how compounding is difficult to spot, and how the fact that it's difficult to spot doesn't mean to say it isn't happening. So compounding isn't something that just happens in your portfolio, it happens in everyday life as well. And yeah, it's a really interesting story centered around a crocodile, Steve, that's managed to make itself pregnant. So that'll be interesting for everybody. I will not spoil it any further than that. I will put a link in the description under what we have been consuming section, and I'll pass to Steve to let us know what he's been listening to.
That's an epic tease. I don't have anything about crocodiles that get themselves pregnant or anything of that that might have anything to do with... finance. You said you've been back to your kind of normal well, or a kind of common source of insight, and I've also been back the same way. I have listened to some other things. I did do some digging around, and I listened to a JP Morgan podcast on inflation, but I can't honestly remember any of it because I think it was quite good. I don't think it was something to laugh at, and I wanted to try and offer something this week that I thought was a useful and insightful one rather than a here's a thing where I want to laugh at this person one. But I didn't get around to consuming one of the things that I wanted to in advance of this. The JP Morgan thing I think was probably quite good, but I was so bored listening to it that I can't tell you anything that was said or recommend it in any interesting way. But I was listening to some of the old shareholder meetings from Berkshire Hathaway, because sometimes I'd go back and listen for bits of stuff that I remember hearing and want to kind of check on again. This wasn't one of those, actually, but I was listening to the 2014 edition of this, and here's something that Buffett said that basically caused me to do something completely different this week to what I was going to do. So said Buffett in response to one of the questions. In 2008, I wrote an article saying, you know, that everybody was saying cash is king. Well, cash may have been king if you used it, but cash was the dumbest damn thing you could possibly own, you know, if you weren't going to use it. And people cling to cash at usually the wrong times. And I kind of got thinking about that in the context of my own portfolio and investing, and Buffett, well known, of course, for wanting a massive cash pile around for security. And I think there's good sense to that. I said maybe last week, I think, that the story of Citigroup is basically they went from having huge amounts of cash around, being pretty well prepared for everything and doing some great deals, but like JP Morgan are now, to not having much cash around and getting into an absolute mess because they tried to overexpand. So I'm not making a case for overexpanding here and saying, right, time to hurl things at the stock market any old how. But it has persuaded me to try and leave some of the excess over the excess that I'd been sat around thinking, let's at least get this ready to go, and let's be looking for stuff to do with it rather than just sitting it in a Marcus account. Because I make this point on JKR's show, basically, I think the next move for interest rates is down, and I think around the time interest rates move down, share prices will move up, which will mean that you'll be either stuck with cash that won't be making very much, or trying to buy shares at higher prices. Buy them now, and if you're, say you're a dividend investor for the moment, you'll keep getting the same dividend yield you're getting now, even if the price goes up. You'll still be getting your whatever it is per share on something or other. Which is why I think it's probably, I'm attempting to move myself into the market more than I maybe was. I'd thought, well, what's a bit more kind of extra security, knocking around earning just under 5%, between 4 and 5%, basically. Trying to get out of that mindset a little bit and trying to get towards thinking, keep investing, keep getting it in there, keep finding things to buy. Not just any old where and not just any old how. And I agree with you that there's a lot of stuff that's sort of a challenge to try and buy at these prices, but there's one or two that are close, and I've been kind of spreading across a little bit. Interestingly, you mentioned Doc Martens. That's done reasonably well this last week, and I'm now in a weird limbo. I computed where my sell price would be. It's about 50% higher than it currently is at the moment, so I thought with the thing running up, I might as well try. Where would I sell this thing? Answer, about another 50% from where we are. So no time soon in all probability. But I sort of also thought it's getting harder and harder to buy this thing here because, I don't know, I'm sort of 50% under the level I'd sell it at, but still don't really want to go buying it too much, which is a sort of odd position to find myself in, I guess. But yeah, looking for opportunities to do things with cash, not forgetting about them, because higher interest rates are your time to be making moves in the stock market, I think. Steve?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Although I think I might be closer to just expanding that Doc Martens position to you. Trading update was out. Was it today, Steve, the trading update? Was it last night? I can't remember. And that was not negative, is how I would put it. I think there was some green shoots of recovery in there, so potentially we're getting this at a decent price. But there's also things like that we'll touch upon Bloomsbury here, that doesn't trade in the Philippines in pesos. For anybody who gets that joke, well done for following me on the Trading 212 community. But yeah, that to me is also looking fairly interesting. That's still a very, very small company putting up really, really good figures. So there's a trading update on that one in just a couple of weeks. I think it's in a fortnight's time. So yeah, be really interested to see how that does, with a view to potentially making that a larger position.
That's a stock that one of my godsons owns in my GIA, and he's doing quite nicely with it, to be honest with you. He's having a he owns that, and he owns P&G, which is means his pie, which is kind of what he's in, is up quite handsomely, actually. He also owns Disney, which is sort of keeping his feet on the ground for him right now. But yeah, lots of good things coming out of Bloomsbury at the moment. I keep looking at my GIA, which has sort of random stuff that I own stashed in there for various things, partly because they won't go in the ISA yet, and partly because they're invested for the God kids, so they don't go anywhere else. But when I look at them, I sort of think, yeah, that's doing all right. Those guys, both of them are up, which it's not so long ago both of them were down, actually. But the other one owns General Motors, so he's in trouble for the time being. But anyway, interesting stuff. Steve, we've got some news kind of from our sponsors, although it's not in their capacity as our sponsors. Trading 212 have got something in the pipeline. What's going on here?
It's 8-0 to Hull KR, by the way, Steve, because I know you're interested in that. But I'll just
that's
quickly...
your one, right?
Yes, that's my one.
Go on,
yes,
the KR.
So...
Sorry, KR.
Very interesting from Trading 212. I don't think any of us saw this coming. I mean, I could have told you there was a card in the works about 4 years ago, at Trading 212. But here it is, Steve. They're launching a card that's going to be linked to your general investment account. You'll be able to use it as it were a standard debit card, so it should be accepted everywhere that MasterCard is accepted, which is everywhere, as far as I'm aware. And you'll continue to get 5% APY on pounds that you hold in the account. Obviously, the different currencies, you'll get different rates. I think it's 5.1 on USD currently, 4.2 on euros, 6% if you're willing to hold the Czech currency, which escapes me at the moment. You'll be able to hold different currencies on that account and get a return on it. And also, Steve, they're launching it with 0.5% cashback on any of your spending as well. So that'll get paid into your invest account. And I think that's up to a maximum of £20 per calendar month as well, so pretty good. All the other benefits that you would get with Trading 212 are also there, so it's 0.15 FX fee, and that's on a true interbank rate, which is actually better than a MasterCard rate. MasterCard rate usually has a little bit on top of it. You might find that even with the 0.15 FX fee in, it might be worth you paying that fee to get the true interbank rate. No monthly subscription, Steve. So yeah, really interesting for Trading 212 to get into this. I knew there was one in the works from a long time ago, but I thought it had been pretty much shelved. It's out now. You can join the waitlist. They're saying it's coming in March 2024. We've had a sort of barrage of features recently, Steve, because Share Transfer's launched on the 15th as well. So today. Trading 212 making great guns. I've put my name down on the watch list for it, Steve. I'll be eager to try it out, because I do occasionally max out the Chase cashback, Steve, and it would be nice to collect it from another source as well.
Yeah, interesting stuff. That's coming at probably a decent time for me. You said it was March this year or next? Sorry, Steve. Next, right?
March this year, March 2024.
March this year. Sorry, yeah. I keep forgetting it's 2024. Okay, that gives me something to think about a little bit. At the moment, I'm busy religiously trying to stuff my NatWest 6% thingy with double-powered roundups, but I don't get any cash back on that, and there's lots of things that I buy that are not very good for rounding up, and not everything nicely ends in something between 0 and 10p on the end of a pound number. So lots to kind of be interested in there. I kind of like the idea of what we've been seeing a fair bit, I suppose, is banks backing their way into becoming investment services. You've seen NatWest do this a little bit, and they tend to have a bunch of fairly structured products of, if you want to own some shares, you can invest in one of these funds that we sort of have, and you can invest in the high risk one or the middle risk one or the low risk one, whatever they are, whatever all that means. Who really knows? It looks like kind of watching Trading 212 go the other way is sort of quite interesting here, right? So a kind of what we would associate as an investment platform, at least first and foremost, then working their way across to doing, I suppose, things that you would traditionally associate banks with doing. It doesn't feel like so long ago to me that Monzo, that both of us own shares in, was kind of basically a card service, right? It wasn't sort of properly a bank. It didn't come with that kind of stuff. It just came with it was a handy way of paying for stuff abroad, from what I can remember when you first got started with it, and then it became a way of paying for things here, and then a bank, and then people got their salaries paid into it, like me, and the rest, as they say, is kind of history. But I think this is an interesting one. I'm not on the wait list yet, but I might well be getting myself onto it, partly because I'd just be interested to see how it all sort of shapes up, really.
Yeah, and we'd obviously love to hear what everyone else thinks of this as well back home. I've seen a lot of people really excited about this on the community. I've seen a lot of people quite interested in it on the Discord as well. So if you're listening at home, let us know. Are you on the wait list for the Trading 212 card? Did you know about the Trading 212 card? And what do you think about the features? Be interested to hear that.
Yeah, share transfers are also kind of interesting to me. I think they become more relevant when it becomes the case that Trading 212 has wrappers that they don't currently have, in my case. But as and when, if and when that kind of thing comes around, and I know that Hargreaves Lansdown were terrible with transferring accounts for me from my lifetime ISA, sort of back in the day, and shifting stuff out of there. You've also had issues with them as well, I think, Steve, with trying to, well, basically pay stuff in the case of, I think it's your daughter's JISA that you were talking about there. But when these things become more, as they develop more wrappers, which I kind of hope they will going forward, then the share transfer thing becomes much more interesting to me, I think.
Yeah, I was after the share transfer when I left Freetrade, and I got offered a chance to try it, but Freetrade messed it all up, so I ended up having to do it manually. But yeah, I don't have anything to transfer to Trading212 at the moment. If they started to offer a SIP transfer, then perhaps I would have something that I could that I could transfer in. But no news on that at the moment. But yeah, I'm hoping that's coming.
I'm hoping that's coming. That's the thing I'd really like from Trading212 next. They are currently associated with our show. That doesn't stop us telling them things that we think we would like to see done better. I think part of the reason they agreed to pair with us is because we tend to be pretty honest with what we think about their stuff, and we say when stuff could be better and have better ideas for how it's done. But it also means you can take it seriously when we say we think something's good on the other side of that coin. Anyway, should we talk about the UK, Steve, great as it is?
Let's do it.
Okay, so there's two big news items from the UK this week. Today is, by the way, Thursday the 15th so far. On Wednesday, it turns out the only thing going up was inflation, or at least price rises anyway. Inflation itself stayed pretty static and went nowhere. But at Valentine's Day, we got news that the CPI was up 4% from where it was a year before, so way above the Bank of England's 2% target. It's level, though, with where it was the previous month, which means it's not coming down, but it also means it's not going any higher. Interestingly, sort of month over month, 4% is in line with the increase from the previous month, which in this case was December. We're now looking at January's data. The level of the CPI was down 0.6% because the year before it dropped by a bit as well from December into January. That might be a bit of kind of seasonal falling off after Christmas, maybe. But depending on how you look at this, it's always interesting to think about where inflation is in various parts of the economy. And goods inflation is basically in line with where the Bank of England would like it. It's 1.8%, which will sort of do pretty much nicely if you're aiming for somewhere in the region of 2%. Trace under that is fine. Services inflation, though, is 6% and a bit up, which is what's really making the overall number quite a bit higher than we would like. And then on Thursday, we got the markets didn't like that very much because, well, the same thing we've been having for what feels like about 15 years now, to be honest, of people think a rate cut is coming and then some inflation data comes and they either think, oh, right, an inflation, if it's good, then a rate cut is coming in the next 10 minutes. And if it's bad, then a rate cut is never coming ever. This was not great for people who think rate cuts are coming. It didn't appear to change many people's assumptions too much, but maybe it just pushed out the date at which rates come down and therefore stock prices probably go up. Into the future, sort of slightly more. I don't mind that. Just gives me a bit more buying time if you agree with the stuff that I was saying a little bit earlier. Today, there was some more interesting news, though. Today being the 15th, the GDP data is in from the ONS on December of 2023 and therefore the full year of 2023, as well as all of the fourth quarter. GDP basically had been coming down through the year, or GDP growth, sorry, had basically been coming down through the year. And the economy contracted by 0.3% in Q4, which is strictly enough to push December's quarter, the fourth quarter, negative, which is strictly enough to take us into two quarters of negative GDP growth after Q3 was down 0.1%, which is down, but not much so you would notice it particularly. Across 2023, the entire economy grew by 0.1%, but it did that at the start and then gave it back towards the end, mostly. Or it did most of its growing at the start and then gave it all back towards the end. I've been looking at that and thinking, okay, so strictly we were in a recession last year in the back half of it. We didn't know we were because we hadn't been through the whole thing yet. The immediate reaction from economists appears to be that this recession is as shallow as they come, effectively, and I sort of get that, right? I mean, down 0.1% and 0.5% isn't much of a downturn in anything. One thing I would note, though, is that so far, GDP has been going the wrong way and accelerating in the wrong direction. It'd be interesting to see where it goes from here. So we're so far looking at a shallow recession, that's true. But I'm not sure that I think things are so obviously picking up. You mentioned at work, Steve, you're on the kind of construction side. A few people in construction have been saying inquiries have been up since the start of the year, which is good and encouraging and so on. But thoughts on either inflation or recession at the moment?
To be fair with you, Steve, I don't really care about inflation anymore. It's proper like chip paper news for me at the moment. Do you know what I mean? I'm sick of hearing about it. I think it's one of those things that I'll be glad when we're out the other side of it, because we'll just have to stop at this sort of like circus act every month where we get this new data out and everybody pretends to care about it for a couple of days. Just not interested in that. The recession, though, was interesting to me because this was, it's been called a political recession, not an economic recession, i.e. that this really hurts Rishi Sunak's credibility, because it was part of his five pledges to grow the economy, and the rest of them happened on their own. So the only one that really him and Hunt had any chance of affecting has failed quite badly. But I was posting about this one on our Discord, and I was trying to explain to people that one of the ways that this sort of GDP gets papered over is by having quite large immigration. So if you've got something of a job shortage, you basically get more heads in to work on those jobs who then go to spend in the economy, GDP will naturally increase. But if you're worried about, GDP only falling 0.5%, but you feel like it's been a lot worse for you, the best thing to look at would be GDP per capita. So in terms of real wage growth, from about the 70s to 2007, we grew by about 33% a decade in terms of real wages. So real growth in the money that was in your pocket, you were getting infinitely richer, 33% richer every decade. Since 2007, it hasn't grown at all. It's completely flatlined. And obviously when inflation kicks in at 10% and you've got no growth in wages, that feels pretty lousy. We're still so far away from what pre-financial crisis records would be. It's obviously really hurting. There was some really good information that came out today that was quite interesting. Like the gaps income per person in the richest and poorest local authorities. Kensington and Chelsea average wage is now nearly £53,000, and in Nottingham the average wage is only £11,700. So there's like huge disparity between what people earn and where they are in parts of the country. So obviously these things are going to affect people differently, because a person with £52,500 should be able to weather something a lot more than somebody only on £11,700. So is it a surprise that the UK has dipped into a recession? No. I think we've been a pretty lousy economy for investing in ourselves and investing in R&D and basically doing anything that would better UK companies and the UK economy at a whole. We've cut public services spending, which, strong public services usually leads to strong GDP growth. And it's all led to this moment that we are at the moment. A recent poll I saw, 6 in 10 Britons think the country's heading in the wrong direction, and only 1 in 10 would actually think that the economy's on the right track. The others, we're in between. So, yeah, it's a pretty doom and gloom economy for the UK at the moment. But as you say, Steve, this is not really, this is not the terrifying recession that people hear about, like a 2008 recession or the dip in, obviously, the economy when COVID hit. That's not one of these terrifying recessions. This is like a small blip, and it could get worse from here. But at the moment, this is a bit meek and mild, and the market reacted to it in the way that you would expect the market to. It just kind of shrugged and carried on. And just to sort of full circle that point, and that's because the market is a predictive force, so it's already predicted that this was going to happen by now. So it's only shocks that move the market. So if the market thinks right, we're going into a 0.5% recession, and the market goes into a 0.5% recession, very little happens. But if the market price is in a 0.5% recession, and the we go into a 2% recession, which is a fairly sizable one, the market would obviously adjust its pricing there and then. So I'm afraid buying opportunities in the UK remain as they were, Steve, which is not bad, but not incredible for the kind of growth you get out of these companies. But yeah, recession is here, and I'm not particularly bothered right now, Steve. How about you?
I'm not particularly bothered about it. I was trying to work out why. I think the reason I'm not particularly bothered about recession is because I immediately think I ought to be. Because like you, I own stuff that is, in some way, its fortunes are likely to be heavily influenced by, they're not necessarily tied in inexorably to, the health of the UK economy. I'm thinking about things like Forterra, which we both own, which will make more money when construction activity picks up. That's pretty much the way it is. In my case, Wetherspoons, which is tied to consumer spending, but has some probable ability to withstand a bit of a downturn there. But anyway, I sort of think, okay, why would a recession be bad in that case? Well, because these companies will make less money. Here's the thing with things like Spoons. They've already reported their earnings for last year. The data tells me what was happening to GDP growth last year. I mean, I sort of already know what the result of that is for the thing I owned. As you point out, it's backward looking. And it's one thing to think, okay, it's backward looking, so when I hear the report for the end of last year, I should expect that to be a bit lower than I previously thought it was going to be, because turns out there was a recession, or we were already in recession and GDP was falling by 0.3%. But I already know everything I need to know about 2023. I mean, I could do with knowing stuff going forwards. The fact that things are trending worse is probably worth paying attention to for me in this situation. But there is a good sense in which I'm not surprised to find we're in a recession. The main reason I'm not surprised to find we're in a recession is because, as I understood it, the Bank of England was prioritising getting inflation down. And that's okay. I think that's a fine priority. I don't like the idea of the cost of living keep going up for, well, me, or indeed people that are worse positioned to handle it than me. So I'm okay with the idea that that's kind of the first priority for things. The issue is it doesn't seem to be working particularly at the moment. Inflation kind of is where it is, and I'm interested in what's kind of going on with the Bank of England's interest rate stuff. Andrew Bailey said basically we are where we are before, and I think he's right about that. There's no significant change, but the question is, at what point are they going to start wondering, maybe we need to give this a bit more of a push to get the last of the inflation off? It feels like losing weight a little bit of... The first bit's come off not too badly, partly because you lap tough comps, partly because it's easy to bring things down from, well, what was double-digit inflation at one point in the UK, basically. When you're trying to close in on that last couple of percentage points, then all of a sudden that becomes a bit trickier to get off, and maybe you need a bit more of a push. So I'm interested in how long they'll put up with inflation sitting at around 4% before they start doing something else with interest rates here. The GDP per capita thing I also did see. I sort of thought of it as a bit like the fact the UK population is higher is basically a bit like a rising share count, effectively. What you have is the same GDP output now just shared between more people, the same way if you had similar flat earnings and a higher a rising share count, just more people wanting or needing or having a claim on the same amount of stuff, which means there's less per person. I'm not sure you can kind of like buy back shares in quite the same way. You need to find a way to move the thing forward in this regard. But I sort of fastened onto this. I'm sort of trying to see inflation as a slightly forward-looking thing, but it seems to me like at the moment the same thing happens nearly every month. We get some inflation data in. Inflation's above 2%. People push their rate cut assumptions into the future. Stocks go either nowhere or slightly down as the people who were more optimistic start rolling off their expectations for the future. And that's pretty much all there is to it. But owning things like Forterra doesn't worry you in a recession that might sort of tip worse for the moment, Steve.
Not usually, well, not really, because they've been quite forward thinking for Terra. They've done a lot of the groundwork in improving one of their facilities, so it's a lot more efficient, and then starting to mothball the less efficient ones as well. So what Forterra have really done is batten down the hatches here, and that's good to see. What you don't want companies doing is sort of panicking in this kind of area and overcorrecting. So just on GDP per capita, Steve, it's actually been 7 quarters now that we haven't had any growth in GDP per capita in the UK. It's actually the longest stretch on record that we've had in the UK. So if people are feeling the pinch and they do feel potentially less well off, then that is reflected in the numbers. That's not just something you're feeling. That's that's something that's definitely happening. But yeah, Steve, Forterra then, is that something that worries you?
No, it doesn't worry me. I think it's something where demand comes back a little bit. I feel on the mothballing stuff, I was listening to Berkshire on this again actually, and making the point of, in some ways you'd like, even not so much with your investor hat on, but you wouldn't mind seeing a kind of shared hardship thing going on where people kind of just pull their hours back a little bit in some operations. But the trouble is that doesn't really work with manufacturing, because you can't run a factory at half capacity as efficiently as you can, two factories at half capacity as efficiently as you can with running one of them. That's kind of just the way these things work, and you have to kind of flex the size of your workforce according to meet your demand here. No, Forterra is a stock I'm still looking at buying. To be honest, I still think there's it's down from where I was initially buying shares in it. I'm kind of looking to keep going there, because it's currently at a position size that looks like a lot, but I don't think will over time. I think it's priced for not an awful lot right now. That's kind of the bulk of my thought of it. The other thought was 7 quarters, by the way. That must be taking us back to sort of close to COVID, when GDP per capita was close to zero, right? So you would be lapping very easy comps, and for good reason. No one complaining that GDP went down during lockdowns and stuff. But if that's the last time we were seeing kind of GDP per capita growth, when we were kind of coming out the back end of things like travel restrictions, work from home, all of those kind of non-essential retail closed and all that sort of thing. It feels like even then, growth in GDP per capita would come fairly cheap back at that point.
Yeah, I think you're forgetting it's 2024 again then, Steve. So 7 quarters back is... Yeah,
7 quarters is only a year and a third, isn't it? It's 2022. Stuff was pretty much fully out by then, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's probably lapping tougher comps because it was a rebound economy, wasn't it?
Yeah, how long we've been making this show. Anyway, let's move ourselves on.
Let's go to Bloomsbury.
Sure. I wonder whether you still had anything on your favourite Filipino stock from you mentioning it earlier, but take it away.
I do, and it's 14-0, Steve, to the correct side of Hull. It is.
Yeah.
So back in December, before that, we covered Bloomsbury as a stock that we thought had done. It was probably being a little bit sort of overlooked in the UK. Steve and I thought it was a really interesting little publishing arm that we had. Obviously, the maker of or the publisher of, sorry, the Harry Potter books, but still with only at the time about a $350 million market cap. A couple of percent dividend yield. It was trading at about sort of 18 times earnings, growing really well. I thought it looked like a really good opportunity. I made it a really decent sized position in my portfolio. Fast forward to the 7th of December, and they put out an RNS, which is a regulatory note to shareholders, I think it stands for. And they said they just wanted to give you an update on trading, and it was titled "Revenue Comfortably Ahead and Profit Materially Ahead of Expectations." And they were talking about how Sarah J. Maas's books had done quite well, and the Tom Kerridge book had done quite well. Poppy O'Toole's book, Poppy Cooks, which is an air fryer book, had done quite well as the Harry Potter Wizarding Almanac, which you probably saw every time you went into any kind of Asda or Amazon over the Christmas period. So they'd done pretty well. It was one of those trading updates without any numbers, so the market largely ignored it. So fast forward again, back in the tab machine to yesterday. Bloomsbury sort of said, look, revenue and profit are now significantly ahead of our upgraded expectations, and we've also appointed a new US president. So this is all without a proper update in the middle either. So this is a trading update where they've essentially reporting ends in about a fortnight's time, and they have given you a profit upgrade and a revenue upgrade twice in this half. So they said in this one that revenue and profit before taxation and highlighted items are now expected to be significantly ahead of upgraded market expectations for the year ending the 29th of February. And the board considers that the consensus market expectation is currently 291.4 million, and profit before taxation and highlighted items was about 37.2 million. So they don't tell you how much higher, but they're saying significantly higher. So make of that what you will. Market sent it up quite considerably this week. I think it's up about 15%. I'm just going to double check. 13.52% on the last 5 days. It's about 20% on the month as well. So doing pretty well. So they gave some more highlights. So they said that Sarah J. Maas's House of Flame and Shadow, which is her 15th book, has reached number one in the UK, the US and Australia, as well as many other markets around the world. But it's also managed to drive demand for her previous books, which they've published throughout the world in the English language. And they have to remind you that they actually have 6 further titles under contract with Sarah J. Maas as well. I've got her first one on my shelf there to read. It tempted me to buy it, so I thought I would give it a go. So fantasy, which is their probably one of their best areas, has grown 54% in the last 5 years. So they have a number of authors in here that do really well, but Sarah J. Maas is probably the biggest, and then there's best-selling authors, Samantha Shannon, Susanna Clark, Alan Moore, and I can't remember the first name, but it's something Lou, who wrote the book Three Body Problem, which is currently a really has been on Netflix. It's I think it comes out on the 21st. It's produced by David Benioff, who did Game of Thrones, and if you watch the trailer for Three Body Problem, that looks very, very interesting. They also said that Ghosts, a BBC companion book, has done very well. Poppy Cook's book has continued to do very well. Pub Kitchen is doing very, very well. The Harry Potter Wizard and Almanac has been a recent bestseller. And a couple of others were going on a sleigh ride. And Impossible Creatures have got to number one bestseller in the UK market and was also chosen as Book of the Year in 2023. So that looks pretty good to me, Steve. That looks like they've just basically released a hell of a lot of books that have done really, really well. The book industry is certainly alive and well, as I guessed it would be when we tried to put this stock forward. And I've had a few people reach out to me, like for just to thank them for putting them onto it, which I think is always strange when people do that, because I mean all we do is mention the ticker really and a little bit of information, and it's up to you to go and research it. And people who have been quite handsomely rewarded on this one, Steve. How is it on your list of things to look at here? Is it gone too far? Is it something that you could have in your portfolio?
Well, my instinct was it's gone too far. It is something I could own in my portfolio, but you said sort of 37.2 in operating profits, roughly on sort of 449 million of market cap isn't too bad. I think your last point is the right one here. The kind of book market is, especially the kind of, I guess, leisure, if I think of it more that way, rather than I'm thinking sort of academic textbooky stuff as the contrast to that. Although Bloomsbury have a decent arm in that, they publish a lot of stuff. But that side of the market's pretty much alive and pretty much well, and the demand for books appears to be quite durable, partly from a kind of gifting angle. It goes without saying that you got me a book at Christmas. I got Poppy's book for a friend of mine, so I bought at least one book from Bloomsbury. And also with some of the kind of more popular stuff that you mentioned, it's not strange, but I think it's worth noting, and something that we don't talk about very much. There is a kind of durable appeal to book groups and book clubs and that kind of thing. People do get together and they read stuff, and it's not always from Bloomsbury, and it's not always super popular, and different people have different interests and so on, but demand for books in general is there. I think with Bloomsbury, The mistake maybe that I made on it when I was initially considering it at a much, much lower price than it currently is I found it easy to get distracted by what they don't have rather than focusing on what they do. So, for instance, they have the rights to the books on Harry Potter, but not the films. And, of course, if they had the films, that would be an entirely different proposition. The thing wouldn't be trading at less than half a billion, for one thing. And it's easy to sort of think, well, okay, wouldn't it be so much better if they were like this? And lose sight of the value proposition in front of you, which is here's what they do have, here's what they cost. Do you think that's worth it with what they do have? Sure, they would be... It'd be much nicer if they did a lot of things. It'd be nice if they made iPhones as well. But they don't. So pay attention to what they kind of do, have and do, and see if you can work out something that's kind of easy to overlook there. And probably where I went wrong in not buying this for my own portfolio, one of my godsons owns it, I'll come back to him in a second, was getting hung up on what they don't have and not paying enough attention to what they do. I bought it for him because he's at an age where I basically just buy stuff that I think is roughly connected to what he might be interested in. And he does like books, which makes Bloomsbury a pretty natural thing for him to own. And he's doing a nice job with it so far.
Yeah, and I was just looking back then, Steve, at the chart as we were... I couldn't remember when it listed, and it's just a few percentage points away from being a 20 bagger, Steve. So if you'd have picked it up, admittedly, you'd have had to have picked it up in 1994. But anybody who did that is very, very much smiling at the moment. So Sarah J. Maas looks like that's a big winner. Six more books to come, which I think will take up to that'll take up to 21 or 22 books, Steve. And if every time we're getting hitting bestseller lists and it's obviously driving demand back to the older books, then here's something with a little bit of longevity. We said when we thought about this stock, we were thinking about the old flywheel mechanism in that the new authors were the flywheel and that Harry Potter and the back catalogue, which continues to sell incredibly well as people introduce more, young people are introduced to the Harry Potter universe. We thought that would be the thing that sort of sustains revenue, and then it's up to Bloomsbury to drive flywheels. And they've done a fantastic job of that, Steve, and look like they continue to do a fantastic job of that. So high on my list to have another look at this, Steve. I'm waiting for this trading update to come out. I hope it's not massively better than the market expects, because it might just price me out. Although at 400 and whatever million market cap, it's not... But it's got to rise a lot to price me out of something, depending on how this does.
Yeah, you're presumably pleased you got yourself a decent-sized stake in this, rather than looking at sort of scaling in, or people loosely say DCAing in. They don't really mean DCAing in, but you know what they're thinking about here, buying a bit and then buying a bit more, and so on. One way you're kind of glad you got yourself in fairly heavily, fairly quickly, see it at a price you like, and don't mess about too much and get buying, right?
Just having a quick look now, Steve, to see what sort of tranches I bought it in. But I bought it 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 times. So, and that was in between the 24th of July and the 13th of October. So I built about 2.5% position in that period of time. And then it's grown about another quarter on top of that. So, yeah, it's quite aggressive.
It's quite aggressive, but it's a good thing, I think. I quite like the idea of seeing something you like the look of, go for it, and then don't worry about it. Just keep your eye on the business from there. See what happens if things all start looking like they're going wrong, right? Then reconsider. But rather than guessing about where the stock might go in the sort of near future, pay attention to what's going on underneath the surface. Sounds good.
Yeah, agree.
Cool. In that case, one last one, then, in that case, which is a stock that I've owned and have been buying since, I think, around September 2022, by the look of things, just zooming back, which is quite a long time for me. Kraft Heinz announced or reported their earnings for Q4 and therefore the full year. And I've had an investment thesis on these that hasn't really changed much since, we'll call it Q3 2022. And that investment thesis appears to be playing out, and the stock appears to be going in the wrong direction, or at least downwards. If you want to buy it a bit more, it's probably the right direction. But interestingly, yeah, I seem to be reading the business kind of okay, and there's not the stock basically. So here's what's going on. Full year net sales came in at 26.6 billion, which was 0.6% higher. Earnings per share came in at $2.31, which was up 21%. In order to make these look like some sensible numbers, we ought to start adjusting them. So the adjusted earnings came in at $2.98, which was up 7%, which is, I guess, a more plausible sort of growth rate for a company like that. So that's all right. Flattish to slightly up revenues and 7% growth from your EPS level. With something trading at around 15 times earnings, that's all right. I think you can call it 21% or 7%. I don't really care which. Either one is fine, as far as I can see. So why is the market getting so cross? Well, it's a decent year, but most of the good year stuff was done towards the start of the year. Q4 net sales came in at 6.86 billion, which was down about 7%. Earnings per share came in at 61 cents, which was down 15%. And adjusted earnings per share, because if we're adjusting them, let's keep adjusting them, came in at $700 a share. Came in at 78 cents per share, which was down 8%. So a bit of a fall off in Q4, probably to do with stuff like people trading downwards and inflation and so on. There were a few things that were weighing on things in different places, but here's the kind of thesis I've always had with Kraft Heinz. It's never been that they're going to start running massive growth or that there's hidden explosive revenue, top line price hiking ability or anything of that sort, and they're going to make loads of acquisitions and stuff. Nah. The thought has been that this is cheap and it's got way too much debt, or has had way too much debt since about 2017-18, when they went doing some acquisitions under 3G, had to write down a load of those acquisitions, and then everything looked like a mess. So what they've needed to do since then was bring their debt down, and as they bring their debt down, things start to get more attractive, and they have been doing a decent job of bringing their debt down. They've run a dividend at about, well, it's been, where the stock has been trading, it's been about a 4% yield. They haven't been deliberately looking for a 4% dividend. That's where the market's been pricing them. But they've kept that dividend fixed pretty much since 2016-17, that kind of time. Haven't increased it, also haven't decreased it to try and do anything more quickly. You might think it would be a good thing if they had pulled that in and tackled their balance sheet a bit quicker. But anyway, they've kept that going for the dividend investors that presumably all own this stock, maybe like me. But their balance sheet has been improving and improving and improving. And I took the view that, look, by the time once they get round to fixing their balance sheet, and they will, because their debt's coming down, they know that's what they need to do. Okay, then we spend less on interest, then we get more through to the bottom line, then earnings go up, then free cash flow goes up. This isn't really a business that I think can do much to acquire things, nor do they really want to. Then the dividend will go up. I was kind of right and kind of wrong about this. So towards the end of last year, they said, look, we have now managed to bring our debt down. They measure their debt, or they look at a different debt metric to me. What I was looking at was basically total debt and seeing how far that was coming down. And it's been coming down and then stagnating. What they're measuring is, in fairness, a measurement that a lot of people do look at, which is their net debt against their EBITDA. So they're taking off the cash that they own, and that sort of thing, and comparing that to their kind of cash-based earnings coming through. And okay, they say, well, look, now we've reached our kind of target level, which is 3x. I actually think that's a little high, but for an industry like this, it's probably okay to live at 3x earnings. You will see generally fairly stable demand. You wouldn't want that in a massively cyclical industry, because you might get clobbered by a downturn and find that you're looking like you've got some ugly net metrics for paying interest. But for someone like Kraft Heinz, it's probably okay, I guess. I'd prefer 2 to 2.5. But now that we're at this 3x EBITDA thing, we're going to buy back 3 billion of our share. We're going to spend 3 billion on share buybacks over the next 3 years. Okay, so I was wrong in thinking that meant the dividend would go up. The return comes via a buyback instead. 3 billion over the next 3 years is where the stock, with where the stock has gone, because it fell 5% on the news, that got up to about 7% of the market cap coming off. And that's quite a serious reduction coming. And I sort of thought, okay, things are starting to come through a little bit here. We're starting to get the kind of returns that I thought might come in. I thought it might come in a dividend push, but they say it's coming through a share buyback. Fine, that's probably slightly better for me from this side of the pond, because I pay a withholding tax on a dividend and I don't pay it on a buyback. So that seemed to all be going kind of well. The market didn't like it very much. The guidance for next year is cautious, and maybe that's what they're kind of fastening onto. But it's got me looking carefully at this and thinking, I don't know, I'm happy holding on past the next year or so. I'm content to think if they keep taking out $3 billion of their market cap every sort of 3 years, bring it down by $1 billion a year or so, you get a reasonable kind of return out of this sort of thing. It looked to me like the thesis is kind of working, but the market doesn't really agree. Steve, any thoughts on any of this?
Just having a look at this capital return now, so $2 billion in dividends and repurchased $455 million of common stock so far. But $155 million of that is offsetting the dilutive effect of equity-based compensation at the management level. Mm-hmm. So you're losing a third of that. Oh, obviously, you're not going to lose a third of the $3 billion. That would be ridiculous. But yes, $155 million is quite a fair amount of equity-based compensation for the year, but also remember, new CEO in place, and he has to get compensated usually fairly rapidly. So you're looking at about $3 billion in free cash flow, Steve, so this is not something that's going to... this buyback is not going to hurt the company in terms of its metrics. I, like you, would have preferred to have seen that dividend cut in half and half of that money probably being shoved onto the debt pile and just to get rid of it. I think a company like Kraft Heinz doesn't need to be trading at 3x leverage, which is oddly their target, which kind of makes you feel like we live in different planets to each other here. But I agree with you in terms of a return here. Actually, I think that you're looking at a dividend push and a buyback push, and if the stock can do a couple of percent growth in EPS and that gets passed down into the share price, Steve, you're probably working your way up to a sort of 7 or 8% return here, which over a long term, Steve, is not to be sniffed at. The issue you've got, I guess, is that you look at the last 5 years when all of this changes, began to happen, and you're sort of stuck in a period of nothingness. It's 0.006% over the past 5 years from, 2019 to today. But that doesn't mean to say that it's a bad stock, Steve, because the past is the past. We don't buy the stock's past, we buy the stock's future. And I think Kraft Heinz is in a decent position here to grow on, I think. So it's not a stock that I would buy. I don't think it does enough. It does enough for me, really. I think I prefer things that just, I can spot the growth there. More sort of growth from within the company rather than sort of, I guess it's like a financially engineered growth, if you want to call it that. But I can see the attraction here completely. I think this is... looks a fine looking business for 15 times earnings here, Steve.
Yeah, I think I probably do sign up to the idea that it's a different business to where it was in 2019, 5 years ago, roughly. It doesn't surprise me that it's trod water with the amount of debt it was carrying. Like I say, I think 3x. I can see why people are okay with it. I'd rather it wasn't that. I'm not in a rush for sort of shareholder returns like that. So I'd rather they, kept the dividend basically and used it to bring that debt load down. But stock-based comp is high, and the new CEO is one where I'm still in wait and see mode. I really liked Miguel Patricio, the outgoing, and thought he did a lot of really good things in terms of getting the company back on the right track in terms of what it ought to be doing. People point out Kraft Heinz is one of Buffett's worst investments, and I think that's mostly people that can only name probably 8 to 10 other Buffett investments. There have been plenty that have been worse than Kraft Heinz. It's a big part of Berkshire's stock portfolio. I mean, it's high up the list of things they have cash in, but if you sort of remember that half of the thing is Apple, about another 10% or so of Bank of America. Actually, nothing after that is a particularly big part of Berkshire's investment portfolio, because there isn't that much of it left once we get past the top sort of 3 or 4, plus whatever mystery thing he's been buying. But I'm interested in keeping watching this one going. It did have a bit of a drop by about 5%, recovered a bit of that today, which is, put it in I'm not sure territory buying wise from here. I thought... if this could knock off another couple of percent, I'd be looking seriously at doing something, especially with other options being a bit limited at the moment. But for now, I'm just going to see how the next couple of weeks and months go, I think, on this one.
Yeah, I think that's probably a sensible idea here. It's not a that's not a significant really a drop, considering it's up a couple of percent today. By the way, 2.3% at the moment. That drop has almost entirely been recovered. So, interesting update this, Steve. Interesting to see the new CEO at work. I'm always a little bit disappointed though to see a company happy to sit on that debt pile like we have, especially with inflation just being a little bit sticky at the moment. And you're thinking to yourself, if the higher for longer people get what they want, then Kraft Heinz really needs to be focusing just a little bit more on its debt. It's times like this where companies should be trying to ship off some of that debt, just get rid of it, get it cancelled, get it paid off. People can wait for a dividend, as far as I'm aware. Once you get the dividend out of the way and you stop having to pay all the net interest income in it, you can whack a pretty hefty dividend back to people, and they'll come flooding back. Also, getting rid of the dividend while you're doing a buyback is a surefire way to get some cheaper stock. It's an interesting business. That would be my tactic for if I was in CEO manship. I would cancel the dividend, keep the buyback, use the dividend to pay off the debt, and buy back stock at a much cheaper rate. And then they'll come flooding back when I put a 28% dividend down, Steve.
Great. You can go and run Kraft Heinz for me. In that case, we've crossed the hour mark, though, on this show, and I've completely forgotten to get to the question that we had lined up. So I'll probably save that one for next week in that case. Meanwhile, thanks very much for listening. I've been Steve. I've been talking with Steve. We've been the Playing Footsie Show, sponsored by Trading212, and we will see you this time next week.